You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Bill Hancock has led a charmed life with the roles he's had in professional sports, in his professional life. But he'll be the first to tell you his best accomplishment was getting his high school sweetheart, Nikki Perry, to say yes 52 years ago. After graduating from Oklahoma in 3.5 years with a degree in journalism, he went to work for the university in the sports information department. Later, after working for his hometown Hobart Democrat chief for 4 years, he joined the staff at the old Big Eight conference where he and I first met. He worked at the Big Eight for 11 years before joining the staff of the NCAA, where he was the NCAA's director of the men's basketball championship for 13 years. He took 3 years off of full-time employment, still working on the tournament, but as a consultant, before accepting the role as the administrator and then director of the Bowl Championship Series, better known as BCS. When the BCS ended and was replaced by the College Football Playoff, Bill assumed the role of executive director, and he's led the College Football Playoff for all 9 years of its existence. Bill, welcome to Sports Connections.
Dave, thank you. It's great to see you, and I appreciate you having me on.
Well, it's really good to have you as part of this. Does it seem like you've been involved in college sports for 50 years?
I was just talking to someone yesterday about the fact that my first year was 1971. I had just finished my junior year in college and only needed 6 more hours to graduate, as you sort of noted, and didn't know what I wanted to do. I was kind of rudderless. And Johnny Keith, the sports information director, said, well, there's a full-time job open here and we'd like you to take it. And I said, well, I don't have my degree.
Yeah.
And he said, well, we know, but you only need those 6 hours and the university will pay your tuition. And it was, I'll never forget, David, it was $136 or $138. And it was more money than I could ever imagine. So the university kicked in the $138 and I joined the staff. And 1971, football at the University of Oklahoma was a really, really good year.
Sure.
And we had the Wishbone, Jack Mildren and Greg Pruitt and company, and obviously played Nebraska in that game of the century on Thanksgiving Day. We lost the game, but all of us who were involved in it will never forget it. Came away thinking, wow, you know, wish we could have won, but we were so lucky to be involved in this. And frankly, that's the way I look back on my career. I'm just very lucky to have been involved in it.
So, and I don't think luck has anything to do with it, but I'll let you get away with that one. Is that when you developed the passion for college sports?
No, actually, I had grown up as a college football fan. I have a photo somewhere of me attending my first game in 1954. My dad had gone to Missouri, so he was a Missouri fan. But Oklahoma, because we lived in Oklahoma was kind of our team. And of course, that was during the start of the 47-game Oklahoma
right.
winning streak.
Bud
so
Wilkinson.
During kind of my formative years from age 4 to 7, my team never lost a game. And I was hooked.
Yeah.
And began to follow this nationwide college football because of following Oklahoma, and then got into basketball and was so lucky to be able to return to my roots in football back in 2005.
Sure. Sure. Now, you worked in sports information for 3 or 4 years. You worked in journalism as the editor of the hometown paper, but you transitioned into administration. Just talk about how that happened. You're heading to the Big Eight.
Well, just kind of right place at right time. My brother and I had inherited our family's business when our father died when I was 24, and that was a newspaper. So he and I ran it together for 4 years, but I kept in contact with the people that I had known from Oklahoma, mm-hmm. Oklahoma SID days, one of whom was Chuck Ninus, the
right.
commissioner of the Big Eight Conference. And they had an opening to be the communications director. And Chuck called me and said, I'd like you to take this job. And so I, in a very difficult decision, decided to leave my legacy in our small town and move to the huge metropolis of Kansas City. And that was in 1978. And we've been there ever since.
And I'm guessing I've known you for a long time. I'm guessing that you don't look back and say, what if very often? So, you're not saying, well, what if I had stuck with the journalism. But do you miss that at all? Do you miss the journalism about writing about sports?
I do. I miss it a lot. And when I went to take over the paper, actually, I was 23. I began to cover high school sports. And I found six or seven little schools in the area and covered their everything, football, basketball, baseball, track and field. And just loved writing about it. I had a network of correspondents who would call me on the phone after every game and dictate the box score. And I'd put it in the paper the next day. And we made lots of people happy, a lot of families happy. And in little towns, as you know, Dave, their pride is built around their sports.
Right.
And so I've got great cooperation. I was not a muckraker at all. When a team lost, I would say it was because the other team played better. And just wrote about a lot of kids. And those kids now are grandparents. And I run into some of them occasionally.
Sure.
Who still remember the stories from 1974, 75, 76.
Now, where in Oklahoma is Hobart? What part of the state?
It's in the Southwest. And I have to correct your pronunciation. Most you are among the multitudes who mispronounce the name of the town.
Okay.
And it's our own fault for having a town named Hobart, H-O-B-A-R-T, which looks like Hobart.
Okay.
And it was actually named for a vice president of the U.S., Garrett A. Hobart, who pronounced his name correctly, as you said it. But somewhere along the way, we started calling it Hobart. It's a rural community, wheat, cotton, a lot of pasture, a lot of cattle. They're in the southwest corner of the state. We don't have any great athletes from our town, but Hollis is close by, where Daryl Royal played, and of course also Ted Owens. I'm proud of where I grew up.
I'm friends with a guy who grew up in Hollis, a guy named Milt Cooper. We worked together at the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and he's been a coach and administrator. He actually coached back in Hollis late in his high school coaching career.
Oh, that's great. Well, this is fascinating. Hollis, besides Daryl Royal and besides Ted, they produce several other great athletes. But the field in Hollis is not named after Daryl, not named after Ted. It's named after a doctor in town, Will Husband. And I think that is so cool that when you go to Hollis, it's like, hey, Will Husband and Daryl who?
That's great. Well, getting back to the journalism side of it, you know, you have been such a good advocate, I think is the best way to put it, for journalists, you know, through the years with your role as communications director for the NCAA or for the Big Eight and your role with the championships and at the NCAA and later in college football. That may be, and I hadn't put two and two together until now, but that may be because you understood what they were trying to do. Do you think that helped you in your role as a communications person with starting with the Big Eight?
No doubt about that. Because it had been my job early in my career, and because I grew up in a newspaper family,
sure,
I understood that journalists were just doing their job. And if I could help them, maybe cut a few corners for save them some time on research and respect them and be honest with them, then I was just helping them do their job, just like I would want someone to help me do my job.
Yeah. You have been the head, maybe that's a little bit too simplistic, but you've led the group that put on championships at the highest level of college basketball and at the highest level of college football. I think I know the answer, but which do you enjoy or did you enjoy more?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I loved the basketball, and I guess I have to correct you again. I was not the head of it. I mean, my title was director, but Tom Jernstead was our boss, and he set the direction for the tournament. I just got to go in and handle the logistics. I loved that tournament. I've been to 41 consecutive Final Fours until last year, of course, and I'm hoping that I might have a chance to go this year to continue my streak, although no one knows. Am I trying to dodge your question, David? I think I am. I love college football, and I was so thrilled to be able to come back to it. But I just can't choose one over the other. I just love both of them.
Now, and I've known you long enough to know that you are not only – I knew you would dodge that, but you have such a great ability to do that. It didn't bother me at all. In fact, I think, and I said, I told you this before, you have an extraordinary way of championing the company line. And I mean that in a complimentary way. I remember sitting by you at a Big 12 championship tournament game when the BCS was just getting started. So we've gone, you know, we've been friends for a long time. I suggested at the time that the BCS was a start was better than the random, you know, you go to this game and you go to that game and then we'll just take a poll. But I thought we needed a 4-team or an 8-team playoff, and you were adamant that the BCS was the right solution. And now you had the college football playoff and you championed that cause. So my question is this: how do you take the company line and make it your own? Because I believe I would have said to a friend in a private conversation, I agree with what you're saying, but I'm paid to say that that's the right answer. But you championed that as if it was deep down, and maybe it was, but it was a deep down heartfelt opinion. How do you do that?
Well, that's not a matter of really not a matter of doing it. It's just a matter of believing. And at the time, I do remember, I can almost go to the place at Sprint Center where we sat together watching that game. I can't remember who played.
No, I was more caught up in who the guy sitting next to me was.
But it's you believe in what you're doing and you understand it. But over time, you know, when circumstances change, then you change your position. And I've never objected to someone who flip-flops. Well, they accused politicians of flip-flopping. Now, that's different.
Yeah.
Because they may change their opinion every week, depending on which way the wind blows. But for me, I knew the BCS was the best thing that we'd ever had in college football for determining a champion. But, you know, over time, BCS, I'll call it BCS fatigue, set in. Mm-hmm. And people were ready for something else. And so I was lucky enough to be able to be a part of creating the college football playoff, which is absolutely the best way to decide a champion.
And I agree with you. I think there needs to be one more step, and I'm not expecting you to answer, but I'm going to ask you anyway, is what is the ideal number of teams in that playoff? I think it's 8. I will tell you that. I think it's 8 because if you've got 5 Power 5 conferences and you have a Notre Dame, you ought to at least have 5. You can't have a 5-team playoff. We know that. Then you've got really good at large. You could get your Power 5. If Notre Dame's up there, give them, and you still have room for a Central Florida from a couple of years ago, a Cincinnati from this year. So that's why I think it's 8. I know you're going to say it's 4 because that's what we have right now, but do you see the value in adding? I can ask it that way and know that I might get an answer for me. Do you see value of increasing it to 8?
Well, I might go into just a little background. First of all, when we created the playoff, we created it for 12 years.
Right.
And frankly, it was to avoid changing every year or so. You remember in the BCS days when they, actually before I started, they changed the formula every couple of years. Remember the K-State rule.
Yeah.
Remember the other rule that was established because something else happened. And it was kind of it was a group of people trying to do the right thing, thinking they were doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. But the changes made it to me a little more confusing and made it where people either didn't understand it or thought the leaders didn't really believe in what they were doing.
Yeah.
So when we set the 12 years, we wanted to make sure we had a good evaluation of what was to come and how the thing operated. We just finished our 7th season, and the CFP is very popular. It's mm-hmm. working extremely well. And I don't want to dodge your question about 8. Maybe the best answer is for me to tell you some of the things we considered when we were setting up the 4-team tournament.
Okay.
One of those, we had a whole spectrum all the way across on the board from go back to the old bowl system where we didn't even try to match teams in a 1-2 in a championship to 4 teams to 8 to 16 and more on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we still know that we have the best, most compelling, most meaningful regular season in sports.
True. Very true.
And we didn't want the postseason to detract from the regular season. I have friends like me that it's like-minded with me, who love March Madness more than just about anything. But what about regular season college basketball? Does it need a shot in the arm? And I think a lot of people could say yes.
Yeah.
Of course, you have to set aside this season. You have to set aside everything about 2021 academic year. But bottom line, back to where I was headed, we didn't want to do anything to diminish the regular season. And so we came up with a four-team tournament, and it was the best of both worlds. Keep the focus on the regular season, don't add any more games for the players, but have a tournament at the end.
Yeah, that's – I mean, you're way smarter than I, so I'm not going to argue with you.
Not true.
I
need a 30 on that day. Not true.
We can agree to disagree on the perfect number and still remain friends. But you just gave us a great example of my next point. You have a way of diffusing an argument against your opinion without making the other person feel less than or talked down to. I mean, we all want to win arguments, and the easiest way is to tell the other person he's crazy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. What's your secret for winning an argument without belittling your opposition?
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. And I believe that every opinion and every person is to be valued and to be listened to. And there are some people on the radical fringes in our country today that I would not particularly want to listen to. But I believe the greatest gift that we have is life, and every life and every person and every opinion is to be cherished. I probably learned that in the newspaper business from interviewing, you know, hundreds, thousands of people during the time that I did that, and realizing that they may have had a different opinion, but that didn't mean that they were lesser person or, and that I wasn't supposed to listen to their opinion. So, We need more listeners in the world, frankly.
Yeah, the old thing, God gave us two ears and one mouth, use them accordingly. too many of us forget that. But being a good listener is definitely a key to that. Now, I know I've set you up as lucky, but I also know that that's not true. Tell us some of the obstacles that you've faced and overcome in your professional career.
Let me talk a little bit about my career. I've really been in the right place at the right time. And actually, I've applied for a few jobs, two or three, I guess, in the actually 46 years, I guess, that I've been in the business in the last 50 years, not counting the newspaper time. Never got a job that I applied for my entire career. All the positions I've had have been where people came to me and said, this job is open and we want you to take it. And that's a blessing. That's just a real blessing. The other thing I learned as a child was the value of work. I loved working, always have. I got a paper route when I was 11 years old. The best promotion I ever had was when I got promoted to janitor at the newspaper when I was about 14. That way I didn't have to go out in the heat and the snow and throw those papers and collect money from the people. I loved my time as janitor, and then they gave me a column, and that sent me off into journalism school. But I've just always worked, and you deal with obstacles by working your way through them. And I hope people today, many people, I know they do, have that same kind of work ethic and really same kind of love for their work. I don't watch much TV. I read a lot. But what I really love to do is work. Obstacles. You respect the other person's opinion, you communicate, and you build consensus. And that's how you get around problems. You don't get around problems by being a bully and steamrolling people. You get around them by listening and explaining your position and trying to learn something and glean something and maybe take some elements from the other person's position.
That's a great explanation. You know, when you were working with the men's basketball committee, and now that you're working with the college football playoff committee, your role is to kind of move things along. in the selection process. Tell our listeners how hard it is to get 10 very smart, very opinionated people sound like a cohesive unit, whether it's football or basketball.
It's interesting about both committees is that they are viewed as singular. The committee did this.
Right.
Well, it's not. It's plural. Our committee is 13 individuals making subjective opinions. And the basketball committee was 10 individuals. Mm-hmm. And they don't discuss and debate and come to a consensus. They do discuss, they do debate, and then they vote. Then they rank the teams. And so it's not a matter of getting them to agree. It's a matter of making sure they consider all the facts, and then they do rankings. In football, a lot of people think that we just – that the committee members just rank the top 25 and we average it some way. Well, sort of like the coaches poll and the journalist poll is mm-hmm. now. That's not how we do it. We have 7 rounds of voting. We vote in the top 3. Then we get another group of teams. We rank those. Those become the next group of 3 and so on until we have the top 25. And then we go back and scrub it. Then we say, did we get that right? Mm. We did the same thing in basketball.
Yeah.
And what it allows you to do is get small groups of teams to compare them together. You know, an 8-4 team is not, you don't have to talk about them in the same pool with an undefeated team. They're right. not going to be in the same place in the rankings. So get your small group, focus on them, analyze every single detail you can find. Our people in football, our committee members watch lots of video. So they're football experts. Mm-hmm. So they can tell who's the best teams.
And yet you're still going to have conflicts. You know, the college football year that just finished, there were people that said, yes, Ohio State definitely is one of the top 4 teams, but did they earn their way in? Cause they only had to play half a season. Other years you've had, and I think back to the year that Baylor and TCU tied for the Big 12 title, didn't have a championship game. And Ohio State, who had lost, I think, to Virginia Tech, who wasn't very good that year, got that last bid because they did play in a championship game. So even with a perfect formula, you're still going to have conflict. Does the committee – well, the committee obviously knows there's going to be conflict, but how do they approach that?
You know, there will always be conflicts. And I think you and I were – I know I was there. I think you were at the NCAA when I went during this time. There was a women's volleyball team that was left out of the tournament, and they were tremendously disappointed. Well, that disappointment became some ugliness, frankly. Mm-hmm. And the ugliness was lodged against our colleague to the point where she had to notify the authorities because there were some real nasty things said and sent to her. It just goes with the territory. When you have an event and somebody just barely doesn't make it, they're extremely disappointed. And our team is team 5. When I was doing the tournament, it was team 65, and now it's team 69. And that will never go away. And we all just have to realize that. And what that does is inspires us, the committee members and our staff too, to just work as hard as we possibly can to get the teams right, because we know that fans will be disappointed, and of course, more importantly, the players and coaches.
Yeah.
But our tiebreakers, if you will, and the CFP are head-to-head games, games against common opponents, strength of schedule, and then conference championships won. And when teams are comparable, then the committee members are instructed to apply those tiebreakers. But it comes down to their subjective opinions after the debate. And when they click in those last votes on the computer, and then I and my colleague can see the results of the votes, sometimes you have to kind of go, wow, look what happened. Because you know how important it is to the people out there who are fans and passionate fans of those teams.
Sure. Bill, I've seen you on stage so many times, you know, with different things that you've done where you're handing somebody a trophy. You seem to be having the time of your life. How long do you see yourself doing what you're doing today?
Oh, I don't think too much about that. I love what I'm doing. And I because I live in Kansas City and I commute to my work in Dallas, I make sure I'm home to see my grandsons in their theater productions. They're both musicians and actors. And there have been several times when I would be at work in Dallas and would stay there until about 3 o'clock and get on a plane and fly home and go to their production that night and then fly back to Dallas to work the next morning. So you do what you can do. You do what you love to do.
Yeah.
And I'm just blessed to be able to do it. And I sometimes I do have to pinch myself and say, wow, that was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
When I started back in 1971.
You've been blessed in your personal life as well. We've talked about Nikki, and I love seeing your Facebook posts of you guys at the Olympics or at a bowl game or at the Final Four, whatever. But you've also suffered some personal tragedies. One of the most poignant books I've ever read is Riding with the Blue Moth, which you wrote about your son Will's death. Talk about the process of writing that book.
Yeah. Grief means something different to every person.
Mm-hmm.
And when we lost Will in the Oklahoma State plane crash, which is 20 years ago, of course, I thought my life had ended. And I couldn't get beyond thinking that why was he taken instead of me? I mean, at the time I was 50. So why I had a life and I had done everything I ever dreamed of doing and then some. But Will only got 31 years. And so you're not yourself. And one of the best things that anyone told me then was don't do anything, you know, keep on keeping on, go back to work when you can and keep going. And I've learned since then about grief and learned that, like a bunch of football players, every football player needs something different from the coach.
Right.
Well, everyone in grief needs something different. And I needed different things in grief than my wife did, than our son's widow did. And you just learn that. And we saw the very best of human compassion.
Yeah.
During that time. And my colleagues at the NCAA, coaches, high school classmates, all reached out. Our grief was a little different than others because it was splashed all over the media.
Right, right.
TV, mm-hmm. radio, newspapers. And so I never encountered anyone who said to me, how's Will doing?
Right.
You know, after he died. And so right. I never had to say, I'm so sorry, but, you know, here's what happened. So that was a blessing. And just learning what people need in grief and learning to help people who come into grief was, I guess, if you look for a silver lining in your life's most horrid situation, I guess that was it for me. It was to help me understand what I could do to help others.
And it was so interesting with that book is that you were not saying, here's how you should deal with grief. Here's how you should deal with hardship. You were just saying, here's how I dealt with it. And in hopes that other people would be able to pick something from there to apply to their own lives. Was that your goal with it as well?
Yeah, that was my hope. I'm not one to foist my feelings on others. I figure they'll look at me and take from me whatever they want to. And you don't need to lecture someone in grief because you don't know what they need. And maybe they do need lecturing. I don't know. I'm not built to lecture at all. But yeah, that was my opinion, was just let open up myself and let people see. And then that was a hard part about the book. It was, I had an editor who helped me with it, who kept saying, Bill, you gotta open up here. You gotta get rid of your shell. And that was pretty hard.
Yeah.
But I think the opening up let people know that I was just a regular guy going through the very same things they've been going through. And you know, David, since we've been having our conversation, how many dozens of people have come into grief, just like we're talking about in this half hour?
Yeah, for sure. Two more questions for you. You've got a second book. Just talk about that one real quick, and then I've got a special one from my wife.
Yeah, I love history, and when I say I read a lot of history, And I decided to write a history book about my hometown. In most most small towns, there are no historians.
Right.
And your history is passed along by word of mouth. And I thought, well, gosh, if no one writes this down, this history down, it'll be lost. So I took it upon myself during a time that I had some time to write a little history of the hometown. I think people liked it okay. Not many people read it, but it'll be there. Somebody will pick it up out of some dusty library shelf in 50 years and say, wow, there was a town called Hobart, and this guy, thank goodness, wrote a history about it.
Now, are those books still available, like Amazon? Do you have a website where people can get it from you? Because I know as an author, you make more money if they buy it directly from you. So where can people get it?
Yeah, they just email me at whancock@kc.rr.com.
And, okay.
That's the way that one sells. Riding with the Blue Moth, the one about the cross-country bicycle ride, that is available on Amazon. And I still hear from, about once a month, I hear from some stranger who says, well, I either I lost my child or yeah. I'm a bicyclist and I'm fascinated by your marathon bicycle ride across the country. And they've picked up the book and they told me that it was helpful. And that means a lot.
Well, that's good. That's good. All right. My last question. My wife is not a big sports fan. She loves watching games with me, but when the game is over, she'll say, who won or who played? But she knew that I was going to talk to you, and she remembers meeting you at a Final Four or at an NCAA function or something. But she asked me one very serious question. We were watching, I think it was the Rose Bowl, which was played in Dallas, which just kind of throws everything out. And she said, hey, I have a serious question for you. And I thought she's going to ask me about why is the Rose Bowl played, you know, in a different state than what we're used to. And she said, after the coin flip, who gets the coin?
Well, you know, they're special coins and right. The referee keeps it. And frankly, I don't know what the referees do with them. We make some others. And the same coin that we do give to the teams.
Okay.
But yeah, that's what happens. And of course, you and I remember the day when the referee would toss a half dollar.
Yeah.
Or maybe a quarter. And I'm sure
whatever he could find in his pocket.
That's exactly right. It's just what I was going to say. That adds to his $15 a game or whatever he's being paid to officiate that game. I forgot where your wife grew up, Dave. Where'd she go to high school?
She went to Shawnee Mission North. So
North, okay.
not too far from where you are right now. We met in church in first grade. So I have not been married as long as you. I've been married 40 years this summer, but probably known my wife about as long as you have. We met in the summer of 1966 when her family moved to my church. And I remember falling in love with her right away. Summer between first and second grade, and second grade boys aren't supposed to like girls. So I courted her by stealing her purse and throwing it into the boys' bathroom, knowing she was too much of a lady to go in and get it. And my mom, we moved away in the summer of 69, right before our fifth grade year. And my mom to this day remembers saying to my dad, it's too bad we can't put Tammy Young in a box and save her for one of our boys. 12 years almost to the day, 12 years later, we got married, and that was in the summer of 81. So I've known her for a while too.
That's really cool. Congratulations on the 40 years. And I'm glad they were able to put her in a box for you.
That's right. That's right. God put her in that box for us. Well, Bill, it's always a pleasure to catch up with you, whether it's at a sporting event or sitting in our living rooms chatting over video. But it's great to spend some time with you, and I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, David. I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.